last couple of years. Been there forever. Braden was our first grandchild, and Matt and Trina invited us to go to the ultrasound for their first baby. I've had this poem read by several people over the years a lot of times, and 9 times out of 10, they don't get it. Until I explain to them what it's about, and then they get it, and they understand it. But the experience of being at our first grandchild's ultrasound, it's hard to explain. If you've been there, if there's anybody who ever doubts that that's a life there, I have no clue how they can write something like that and feel that way. But this is based on our standing in a small room with Matt and Trina, Lorraine and me, and watching the ultrasound of our first grandchild. So I apologize if it sounds vague, and a lot of students who have read this before have no clue what it's about. And then I explain it, and I say, look for the clue. Look for the clue. It says, huddle before the claustrophobic stage. Bring down the light. Lower voices to a hush. As the curtain rises, at the stroke of the wand, she appears in monochromatic splendor. Quiet gasps fill the room as the dance begins a cappella. Supple limbs stroke the stage with fluid twists and rapid pirouettes as the sound of silence floods the star's silver screen in her debut. She dances in double time, naked heart and breathless. Finale, curtsy, curtain, and the audience rises in tears. Okay, number 11. In 1973, Roe v. Wade, as you know, was the law of the land. In 1972, when Lorraine was pregnant with Matt, and we went to Lamaze classes, remember those? Teach two very naive young people what they're supposed to do when the baby comes. We had no clue what we were doing. So we went to Lamaze class. And one of the sessions that we went to was a session on the advanced stages of labor, of pregnancy. And the instructor said this. He said, those of you who have gone through this experience of quickening, and quickening is the point about 3 months or so when the baby first moves in the womb. And they said, explain to us what it felt like for you. And this poem is a description that three women gave of what they thought it felt like in the womb when the baby moved for the first time. So it's a combination of those three things. It's called quickening. A risen bubble burst the surface of a gently rippling stream, number one. Sending a single spider marching over a fluttering wing beneath her hand. So, bubble, spider, fluttering wing. Those are what three different women said about what they thought the quickening experience was for them. That's where that poem came from. Number 12. About 1973 or 74, right after Roe v. Wade was made the law of the land, there was an epidemic of abortion clinics that opened up around the country. It became the business to get into. I mean, huge amounts of profit and money came out of the abortion industry. There was a picture that came out in a big newspaper, might have been the New York Times, where somebody had actually gotten behind an abortion clinic. And they had taken a picture of a 55-gallon drum full of aborted fetuses. It was shocking. It was shocking. And when I saw that, I first of all could not believe in the inhumanity of all of that. And then I began to think about the idea that every one of those fetuses, or babies as they call them, would have been somebody. Now, not necessarily a good person. I don't know what they would have become. That's the whole point. We don't know. So it's called potentiality because based on the idea that any baby that's not allowed to be born had something planned for its life. There was some plan for its life, whatever it was. So this poem is based on the idea of we never know what that unborn baby would have been, could have been, if they'd been allowed to come, good or bad. In a fetal waste can between a man of God and a sadistic killer, two lovers touch. That's it. Oh man. This is terrible. I'll never get through this one. This one's bad, so forgive me ahead of time. Number 13.
I didn't. Okay.
That's my brother Kim. In 1983, my brother Kim called me. He was in the Navy and lived in Washington, D.C. He called me in 1983 and gave me the terrible news that he was HIV positive. In 83, when AIDS first hit our country, that was a death sentence. Almost without exception, people who got HIV and developed AIDS died. That's just what happened, and usually fairly quickly. He was lucky. He was in D.C., had access to Walter Reed Hospital, one of the best hospitals in the country, and for 11 years, he fought HIV, developed into AIDS, and finally, it killed him in 1995. This poem is based on experience that we had when, as the disease got worse and worse, and those days before the medication we have today, basically what it does is just completely destroy anything you have in the way of an immune system, and you get everything. Towards the end of his life, he had everything from shingles to neuropathy to arthritis to blindness in one eye. Just everything was wrong. And couldn't be there with him. Went to visit him, actually, a couple weeks before he died. My first and hopefully only plane trip of my life. I did not have a good time at all. It was terrible. But when I saw him just a few weeks before he died, probably weighed, if he weighed 75 pounds, would have been lucky. He was bald, you know, emaciated, almost nothing left of him at all. And it was a really difficult trip for us to take. We needed to go see him during that time. We came home, and this was in December. December 31st, our church, our small church in Convoy, always had something we called a watch night service. And on New Year's Eve, we would gather together at the church or at someone's home, and 8, 9 o'clock or so, we'd all get together and have fellowship, play games, and you know, when we were younger, we used to stay the whole night. We didn't do that after a while. And just watch the new year come, you know, and pray in the new year. And this particular year is at my house. So during the time, we were at our house, and Lorraine did her usual making food kind of stuff. And every once in a while, I would go to the phone, and my mom, who had flown out to D.C. at that time to be with my brother, would give me the update. How's he doing? Not good. Every once in a while, I'd get another call and check up on him. Had been doing that for several days because he was in the final stages. And if I describe to you what his last days and hours were like, it's a horror tale. It was just terrible. Glad I wasn't there. I really am, because it would have been a vision, an image that probably never could have gotten on my mind. But this poem is based on that experience. Honestly, I don't know that I can read it. I would just butcher it. I'm sorry. I just would butcher it. Is there anybody who is brave enough to read this for me? Lorraine can't read it. John is my teacher's pet. I will try if you make me, but I'm just telling you, it's like it was yesterday, and it was 30 years ago. How long ago was it? 95, 20 years ago. 20 years ago. He was 40 years old when he died, and it was just very, very difficult. I could go on and tell a lot of stories about him. He lived around here for a while, and I had the chance to share with him about the gospel before he left, and I'm pretty sure he knew where he stood before he left, and I was glad to have a chance to do that. But this is a description of what it was like in my house in Convoy the minute before my brother died and the last phone call that I made. So, yes, please. Thank you. Bless your heart.
Oh, no, I'm good. I can read that.
Thanks, 361.
Two hours and 15 minutes from the new year, my brother died. A long time coming. For over a decade, his life had diminished. The list of symptoms had lengthened, like death understood that entering the new year was unlikely at best. Most only live with it 5 years, Dan said. So here in the Midwest, as for tradition, we gathered together to share leftover Christmas wishes, listening to fading carols, and anticipate the dropping of the ball. I would occasionally slip away to call the East Coast hospital room and ask the hard question. And then 2 hours and 15 minutes from the new year, my brother died. It was no surprise, a long time coming. But the sobbing pulled me to my knees as I clung to the kitchen counter under the hands of friends. And 2 hours and 15 minutes from the new year, the gathering ended.
Thank you, Deanne. I could not have done that. So. Any questions about that poem at all? That one hits home really closely. Number 14. Lorraine says, I went to a morbid stage, which hasn't stopped yet. Wrote about death a lot. This one's based on my critical morbid period, where I was just wondering, why did we spend so much time and money and energy on funerals when there's nobody there anymore? And I wondered about that all the time. And I came to understand, as I matured, there was more to it than that. It happens as you grow older, as you go through more funerals, as you experience those things in your life. It's so hard. It's so hard. But you begin to understand, it's not about them. It's about those who are behind, about the ones who left behind. And this poem is based on an experience I had where I just changed my perspective on, instead of going to a funeral and saying, look at all the wasted money on this and this and this, I began to look at the faces of the people and understand that it's not about that. And I guess part of it was because Lorraine and I used to take walks around the Convoy Cemetery, outside of Convoy. And I would walk around towards the back of the cemetery, and here was a huge mound of dead flowers. You know, and I was thinking to myself, all the money had been wasted there. But it's not about that. It's about the ones who were left behind, the people who were there. So this is called the viewing. We shuffled slowly in her direction, shaking the hand or softly touching the shoulders of ones last seen at crowded wedding receptions or distant summer reunions. Heavy fragrance of a tapestry of rich roses, clovis carnations, and fern fronds tickled our noses as we advanced the polished green of the yawning casket. She wept softly, hugging an awkward well-wisher who fed her carefully prepared condolences that did little to appease her starving spirit. Taking her hand, I spoke the words. My mind questioned the somber ritual, debated the morbid display, and criticized extravagances for one no longer there. Then, once again recounting his last moment, she tenderly stroked back the thinning hair, adjusted the skewed eyeglasses, and lovingly kissed the cold forehead, and I understood. All right, number 15. That's not me, but it could be. I looked like that when I was that age. I dressed like that. My hair was cut like that. I had a dog like that. So maybe somebody secretly took my picture and stuck on the internet someplace. But when I was just a young kid, about 8 years old, we lived on Main Street here in Van Wert, not too far from where the Orchard Tree is right now. Back in my day, Main Street was the main thoroughfare. I mean, everything that came by here came through here. And we lived on Main Street, so a lot of traffic there. I had a little black dog named Putty. And bad place to have a dog, and sure enough, as an 8-year-old little boy, I had the opportunity to watch my dog get hit by a car and killed in front of me, right in front of me. And this is based on that experience so long ago, but a lot of us know that some memories just never go away. They just never go away. It says, a sweaty man in dirty t-shirt blocks traffic with his rusted pickup truck, quickly grabs a spade and scrapes up a lifeless mass of blood and puppy fur, leaving stains on highway asphalt and on the memory of a motionless curbside boy whose eyes hold tears as big as 8 years. I don't have a lot of funny ones, do I?
Very much enjoying your talk.
real fun guy. All right, 16, number 16. It's not based on experience, but an idea, a thought. And there are books out there called A Turtle on a Fence Post. I've seen them before. It's based on this idea. When I was growing up, I spent a lot of time down at the creek, called the creek. And my parents had no clue where I was 9 times out of 10. I was just gone down the creek and fishing and all kinds of stuff. And this is based on the idea of I saw a lot of turtles and a lot of frogs and a lot of snakes and all kinds of stuff. And it's based on the idea of this. If you talk to anybody about the origin of life, where we came from, where the creation began, you're always going to get to a point someplace where you're going to have to ask them, but where did that come from? You can never get to a point, it was all Big Bang Theory. Well, where did that come from? Well, some matter exploded, but where did that come from? You can never get to a point where there's not a place where something had to be created by somebody. And this poem is based on the idea of a boy who finds a turtle on the fence post. And people actually have done this. You take a turtle, stick him on a fence post, his legs stick out, he can get hold of nothing. All he does is sit there and flail his legs. He can't move. And if you find that, later on, the question, the poem comes up, who put him there? Somebody had to put him there. He didn't cross the post by himself. He wasn't flying and landed on top of a fence post. Somebody had to put him there. So it's based on that idea of origin. Where did things begin? Somebody had to do something. There had to be a creator somewhere along the line. It says, a fragrant trail meandered through sweet clover behind a gangly 14-year-old. With Zebco and battered tackle box in hand, he waded through the shin-high green toward the bend in the creek. He pronounced it crick. For a brilliant pumpkin seed, feisty bluegill, and hook-swallowing yellow bellies promised at least a distraction on a warm summer afternoon. Near the stand of trees that caught his eye, a weathered post chest high, scarred with rusty remnants of barbed wire and staples, held aloft an earth-toned turtle, suspended an alien world. His prunish legs, sun-dried, slowly paddled the unresisting air as it futilely strained toward the scent of muddy water. Like an infant lying on her milk-rounded belly, it flailed helplessly, instinctively, almost mechanically, as it labored to reach the unattainable. The boy stared, briefly, then heroically lifted the condemned hostage to freedom and watched it plod slowly toward the promise of new life. A turtle on a fence post. For several minutes, the boy theorized, imagined, calculated, supposed, and questioned the origin of that which he had seen. A turtle on a fence post. Then he yielded to the only obvious and undeniable fact. Knowing nothing else, he assured himself of this. He was placed there by someone's hand. So it's all about things coming from someone. All right? Stick the ASPCA on it. 17. And the last two poems are from the last section of my book called Faith, and their poems are written about faith. And 17 is called Lament. And it's based on this idea. I'm a Christian. I've been a believer since I was 16 years old. That doesn't mean, though, that life isn't really tough sometimes. And I don't just mean tragedy happening to us. I also don't mean people dying and sicknesses and disease. I mean, there's some days I just feel rotten. I just don't want to get out of bed in the morning. And I just have the blues, or whatever you want to call them. I just don't feel like I'm excited about anything some days. And sometimes the origin of all of that, believe it or not, is church stuff. I get too busy with all our church stuff. I get thinking too much about church stuff. I get worrying too much about people in church. And I feel bad about that because I'm supposed to be joyful and exuberant and happy all the time, and I'm not at all. Lorraine can tell you, I can be a pretty down guy sometimes and not fun to be around a lot of times. I think too much sometimes. And this poem is about giving me permission to have days that I don't feel like I'm God's, I don't know what the word you want for, God's poster boy. You know, I'm not that person all the time. And if you've not had those kinds of days, oh, you're a liar. We all have those kinds of days. We just don't feel like we're supposed to be, we just don't know what we're supposed to be doing, how we feel. And this poem is called Lament. And Lament is just like it's a sad statement. It's the idea of lamentations in the Bible. But basically, it's just one of those days I had where I was thinking to myself, I'm a Christian. I should be enjoying life. I should be praising God. I should be happy about everything. And I'm just not today. I'm just not. And I found out from that idea that when I have days like that, you know what I do? I praise God anyway. Even I don't feel like it, I praise God anyway. And I just tell myself, and we both had this experience before, Lorraine and I have had this, we tell ourselves this, this is one day. This is a day. Tomorrow will be better, or the next day will be better. It's one day. So my apologies if this comes across as being less than having the Christian attitude, but most Christians I know, we have stinky days once in a while, and this is just reminding us that even on the stinky days, and maybe especially on the stinky days, God is still there. Alright? It says, I'm real tired, Lord. I'm bone weary and brain drained. It seems that brushing my teeth and checking my mail and answering the phone and hearing complaints and soothing hurt feelings and tears and frustration are now a daily routine. You know what I mean? Rest is a luxury, sleep a relief, and I rise the next day to new problems and grief. Why does it have to be that way? But you know, Lord, I have noticed one thing. When the feeling, when the fatigue and frustrations abound and no end of problems are found, I turn more often to you. I'm whispering hymns to myself through the day. It's no longer a task for relief when I pray. I just don't have time or the strength to stray, and fellowship isn't a pleasant diversion, but food to a starving soul. You know, Lord, I'll be honest. I really don't like it. But the truth is, Lord, I thank you for it. Though it really is quite a test, I know that truly it's the best. And though I may often call out in fear, what in heaven's name is happening here? I'm assured by the peace that you give, as long as my faith in you lives, that you're in the midst of it all. And as long as I trust and I lean on you for the strength that I need to see me through, someday each piece in your hand will fit, and someday I'll understand, and then I'll rest, Lord. All right, last one. I appreciate your patience and really appreciate you coming out and Dave forcing me to do this. It's called The Planter. I told you I've been a Christian since I was 16. Grew up in a small church, spent most of our lives there. Went away to college. While I was in college in Kentucky for a couple of years, we were involved in a small church. Came back to Defiance, where I just found out Sarah graduated from the same school I did, from Defiance. And small church, came back to our small church. I spent my whole life in small churches. I've all ever been in small churches. And I know the work that goes into small churches. I know how difficult it is. I know the struggles that go there. I've never been a pastor, but I've been friends to pastors and supporters of pastors and tried to back pastors as much as I can. So I know how difficult it can be to be in a small church. We get discouraged. We look around us, sometimes at bigger churches, and wonder why our church is small and why aren't we doing more than we are doing or should be doing maybe. And I realize that we never see the end result of what we're doing. We plant seeds all the time. And a lot of people that I know grew up in small churches. My kids grew up in small churches. And knock on wood, if I could find some, they're doing okay so far right now. It's not about being a small church, but this is a tribute to the pastors, especially, and church leaders who are involved in small churches who just plug away at it, who just keep working, knowing the church is going to be small, may always be small, may never grow to be bigger, but God is still working there, and God is planting seeds there, and God is being praised there, and that's what's important. So it's called The Planter, and it's kind of a tribute to small church pastors and leaders. It says, before the morning sun can rise and cast its light across the sky, the planter bends his knee to pray upon the labor of the day. The fields before him, broad and vast, some bathed in light, some overcast, still show the signs of sweat and tears of laborers of former years. But knowing power of the seed, the battle stones and strangling weed, the planter works throughout the day, spreading seed along the way. Despite the care and patient toil, most fall on hard and arid soil, but still a planter casts the seed, for hunger is the greatest need. Sometimes the seed springs up like grass, and only a moment seems to pass. Sometimes like corn, two seasons long, he waits to hear the harvest song. Sometimes an acorn will be sown, requiring years before it's grown, producing fruit from age of tree the planter's eyes will never see. But still the planter labors through a day as he was called to do, believing this is not in vain if life emerges from one grain. And that's it. Thank you very, very much for coming out.
Thank you, Keith, for doing that. Thank you, Lorraine, for the cookies and the brownies. Thank you to the 20-something class that helped set some things up. Keith is available. I asked her, I said, will you please make yourself available or sign books? Anybody that brought their books tonight, or you did bring some books, and those are available.
You can have your books for that.
Yep. And so now's your opportunity to do that. Otherwise, thank you for coming.